Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Rhiannon Giddens has had one of the more unusual career paths of any musician I know of. She studied opera, training to be a soprano at one of the most prestigious music programs in the country. But almost by chance, she fell hard and deep into the study of American folk music. She became the front woman of a string band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops, focusing on reviving forgotten musical traditions of the Black diaspora. And they received a Grammy Award 10 years ago.
While he was scheming, I was beaming, and his beamer just beaming. Can't believe that I caught my man cheating, so I found another way to make him pay for it all.
As a solo artist, though, she's moved increasingly far afield. I spoke with her after her album There Is No Other came out in 2019. She was exploring folk styles from the Middle East and Europe as well as early America in collaboration with the musician Francesco Tarisi. She's nominated for a Grammy for another album with Tarisi called They're Calling Me Home.
Can I have your C? Isn't and the banjo tuned to the accordion the beginning of a joke? Some sort.
When we spoke, they started off by playing Wayfaring Stranger, a traditional song dating to the 19th century.
Form shall rest. lurks beneath the sun. I'll drop that cross of self-denial and enter in at home with God. I'm going home to meet my Savior. I'm going home, no more to roam. I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going.
Rhiannon and Francesca, that was magnificent. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Rhiannon, I have to tell you that I think it was 6 years ago already,
Oh my gosh.
That there was this amazing night at Town Hall in New York that was put on as a kind of promotion and concert for Inside Llewellyn Davis, which was about the folk scene of the late 50s and 60s. And it was a pretty good lineup. It was good lineup. Joan Baez, so many people. And you got up and brought the house down and brought the house to its feet. Tell me about that night, what you sang and what that was like, killing like that.
Well, it was a really interesting experience because when T-Bone asked me to do it, you know.
T-Bone Burnett, who produced the album and all the music for the film.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't done a lot of solo stuff at that point because I'd just really been doing the Chocolate Drops and, you know, it was not with my band. It was, you know, it was all very instinctual. I was just like, I just want to not screw up. I don't know. I was kind of so shocked by the response to it, you know, that the following days, the write-ups, I had no idea it was such a big deal. It was literally like ghosting the song and don't screw it up, you know. And
did it change your career? Did it change your life in any way that night?
It did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's how my next two collaborations were with T-Bone, and that they totally came out of that night. My solo record, Tomorrow's My Turn, I had no intention of going solo anytime, you know, soon. I was like really focused on the Chocolate Drops and was very excited about it. And then it was kind of like, well, you know, and T-Bone Burnett says, let's do a solo record. You don't go, can you come back in a couple of years? You just go, yes, you know.
Now, your records are often categorized as something called Americana, which is a term that you hear a lot, and it gets stuck on folk music, all various kinds of music. Do you embrace it? Do you reject it? And what does it mean to you?
I have a complicated relationship with Americana as a term. I have a complicated relationship with genres. I hate them. Number one.
You just want it to be called music.
I just want it to be called music, or even American music's fine. You know, acoustic music. Now, Americana, I understand what they're trying to do. You know, commercial country kind of has gone down this certain road, and they're trying to create a space for the singer-songwriter, for the story song. You know, I get all that. I still feel like, you know, you make a genre, you tend to narrow into it.
Now, you're on your third solo album, and you've got a new collaborator who's sitting here with us, Francesco Terisi. Tell me about your musical relationship and how this came to become an album.
Well, yeah, I guess it's kind of it was just one of those kind of magical things. Do you want to say how?
I got in touch first with Rhiannon about 4 years ago. I knew about the Carolina Chocolate Drops and I'd heard some of the music. I was doing a lot of research at the time in the early history of jazz, and I thought it was a very interesting take.
Scholarly research.
Well, I was lecturing history of jazz. I mean, we're both kind of musicians who have a lot of interest in research, so I don't know if I would call myself a scholar, but we read a lot of books, put it that way. So I just thought it was a very interesting missing link that nobody talks about, the black string band in the history of early jazz. And
well, tell us about that. What is the missing link, and just describe what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about this, but the way I saw it was just that, you know, because I was actually teaching history of jazz in a BA course in Dublin, which is where I live. We both live in Ireland. And just reading all the classic literature on the early history of jazz, everybody focuses very much on the brass bands and the importance of that kind of in New Orleans and the development of early jazz. And the string bands are never really mentioned in that transition between ragtime and early jazz. And they were obviously a big part of it all. Maybe you should say something about
right.
that, because that's your corner.
Fill us in. What are we ignoring? What are we missing?
Well, the string band, and the black string band in particular, you know, it really is at the heart of so many, here we go with genres again, the genres of American music. And it was a widespread phenomenon, you know, that goes back to the time of slavery, when black people were seen as natural musicians. They were encouraged to pick up instruments and then play for white people's dances and frolics and parties. And so you have the combination of, you know, native rhythms and modes from West Africa, from all over where people were coming from, and instruments that were coming over, like the banjo, which grew out of West African lute-type instruments. I mean,
how much of this do we have recorded?
It's huge. Not any. That's the problem.
So how are you excavating the music in a way?
With dots. You know, with the sheet music.
That must give you a very wide berth on how to play it.
Well, the thing is like, there's a lot of scholarship that's been done on these early banjo tutors. They were very, very clear on how to play this instrument. And
you keep saying this instrument. We have one on the floor
here.
Yeah,
sorry.
Can you describe what this is? Because it's obviously not the kind of thing that you'd see Earl Scruggs play or.
Yeah, the banjo that I have is a replica of, well, it's kind of a composite of some banjos from the late 1850s. It's a wooden banjo. See, the early minstrel style banjos were all fretless. People are always surprised by this because it's fretless and they were gut string. And that's because they were that one step removed from the homemade gourd instruments that black folk would have been making on plantations or wherever. And that was the banjo first. And so they were all be playing these kind of instruments, which are wooden hoop, wooden fretboard, fretless, and it's just a deeper, more resonant, sort of round, warm sound.
And Francesca, you're playing a drum that is called a...
Duff.
A duff.
It's a drum that comes from Iran. It's a large frame drum that has got a particularity that has got little iron rings hanging. And they could kind of, by shaking the drum, you hit the skin and they create a really washy type of sound.
Give it a little... So these many dozens of rings that are on the inside lip of the drum, that's what makes that kind of haunted
sound. Yeah, so it's a drum that you find in Iran and in other countries in Central Asia, used in folk music, but it's also an instrument used by Sufi brotherhoods, and they use it for trance dancing, you know? So this kind of washy sound very often you find in cultures related to trance, you know?
And what you're going to play, is a kind of ghost story in a song called Little Margaret.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
That was actually one of the earliest things that we connected on, this idea of the drum, the frame drum in across the ocean, Middle East and in North Africa and the Mediterranean being a drum that's supposed to be played with a singer. You know, because it's got a tone to it. And so we were looking for that connection. And I thought, well, Appalachian ballads, like they also have that trance feel as well. And so it just worked so beautifully. Little Margaret is I learned from Sheila K. Adams from Western North Carolina. And it goes all the way back to, you know, some English ballad from centuries ago.
We don't know who wrote it.
It's old. It's really old, like 14th century. I mean, it's like old. It goes back. But this is an Appalachian version. And it's basically the story of a young woman who was in love with a man. And he goes out, starts, you know, seeing somebody else. Later that night, she appears to him at his bedside. And he sees her and realizes that it's her that he wants. And so he goes to visit her, and then he finds out that she's died. And in the song, the imagery is basically that her appearing in white means that she's a ghost, even though he doesn't realize that. And then when he goes to her father's and she's in her cold black coffin with her face turned toward the wall, her face turned toward the wall meant that she was a suicide. And then at the end, when he falls into her arms, that means he dies. Like, so these are all kind of... imagery that were used in lots of different ballads to sort of denote these things without actually coming out and saying them.
Spooky stuff.
Spooky stuff, yeah.
So I'd love to hear it.
Well, let's do it.
Little Margaret sitting in her high-hole chair, combing back her long yellow hair, saw sweet William and his new maid bride riding up the road so near. She threw down her ivory comb, threw back her long yellow hair, said, I'll go down and I'll bid him farewell and I'll never more go there. It was late in the night, they were fast asleep. Little Margaret appeared all dressed in white, standing at their bed feet, saying, how do you like your snow white pillow? How do you like your sheep? Saying, how do you like that pretty fair maid who lays in your arms asleep? Very well do I like my snow white pillow. Well do I like my sheep. Much better do I like that pretty fair maid who stands at my bed feet. He called a servant man to go saddle the dappled roan, and he rode for her father's house that night, knocked on the door alone, saying, is little Margaret in her room or is she in the hall? Little Margaret's in her coal black coffin with a face turned toward the wall. Unfold, unfold those snow white robes, be they ever so fine, for I want to kiss those cold, cold lips, for I know they'll never kiss mine. Three times he kissed her cold, cold hand, twice he kissed her cheek, and once he kissed her cold, cold lips, and he fell in her arms. Asleep.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And you, what, how much of this song was given to you and how much of it is yours in terms of its invention or melody?
I mean, that's, you know, it was originally an Appalachian ballad, like unaccompanied. So it's, I'm singing it just like that. What I'm doing is when we first started playing it, I just sort of, instead of just going through the song, you know, with no pauses in between the lines, there were moments where the drum kind of, I would slow the action down a little bit, and then when it speeds up again, so that definitely came from me just kind of reacting to what he was playing, you know.
Rhiannon Giddens. I spoke with her in 2019, and our conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm speaking today with the musician Rhiannon Giddens, who was just nominated for 2 Grammys, Best Folk Album and Best American Roots Song. Giddens and I talked in 2019 when her album, There Is No Other, was just out, in collaboration with Francesco Turisi. We'll continue now. Rhiannon, you went to Oberlin. You studied. You had formal training there.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of opera.
Mm-hmm.
How did you become you? How did you kind of create yourself and your sense of direction and where you would go in music, coming out of a place like Oberlin where you had had this formal training?
Did you
think you were going to be singing Les Somnambules being an opera singer?
We all do, coming out of conservatory.
Right.
We're going to be the next big soprano, you know?
What happened?
I discovered folk music, and I discovered the banjo, and I also... You know, I'm very interested in doing something that is A, of service, and B, that not everybody else is doing. So I was like, gosh, there's like a million sopranos in the world who can sing as good or much better than I can,
yeah,
who can do these things and want to devote their life to opera, where I'm seeing this other thing and I'm like, this is something I think I can make a difference in, you know? And it touches me and it speaks to me. And so it goes to show that you have to find the thing that you are meant to do, you know, and you don't know what it is always, but if you follow the thing that's speaking to you, you just don't know where it's going to lead you.
Well,
you know?
I hate to pound on this notion of categories, but what you just sang, is that classical music in a sense?
No. I mean, but then what, I mean...
That's what I mean.
You know, what is classical music, you know? I mean, we do on the album 2 arias, you know, but we do them in vernacular voice and with a sort of improv accompaniment, and it's like, they live in a different realm and they touch people in a different way, but they're, you know, does it still mean that they're not an aria anymore? I mean, that's kind of also the point of the record is, you know, who cares this is not just smashing stuff together. Like, that's important to mention. It's not like, you know, I mention our similar approaches because I think that's why our layers kind of work, you know, because we're layering things on top of each other and finding where the peaks, because there's all of these similarities between all of these different things, and
right,
and it leads us to, you know, what music is doing for us as humanity, you know, because somebody was saying, well, you know, our diversity is also our strength. You're saying that we're all the same. I'm like, well, in our differences, we're the same.
Yeah.
That's the point, is that, you know, we express ourselves in different ways, but it's all coming back to these universal truths as humans, and the more that we can reject that idea that you are over there and you sound different to me, so that we're different people, and embrace that actually what I do in my culture and what you do in your culture is coming from the same heart, and therefore they should be able to work together. You know, that's more of what we're trying to say.
How does that relate to the next song that I think you're going to do? And you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation to get it exactly right.
Yes.
Pizzica di San Vito.
That's pretty good.
And means?
Pizzica is a type of dance from Puglia, which is a
southern
Apulian
Italy
region, mm-hmm, you know. So it's a type of tarantella, which is a very lively, I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of that. But the particular thing about this music that a lot of people don't know about is that it was music to cure the bite of a spider. And it was, no, this is a very serious thing, actually. The idea with the pizzica is that you got bitten. They believed in the bite of the spider, tarantula, that's why it's called tarantella. And you would fall into a state of depression. And the only way to get rid of this was to trance dance, which could go on sometimes for weeks. You know, the musicians would come to your house.
So it's pre-antibiotics.
Definitely pre-antibiotic. Mind you, this was the last time observed in its full power, wow, in the 1960s. 1960s was still happening in Puglia.
Incredible. How is that tuned? How is it tuned?
C, well, right now it's in modal. But I have like three different tunings I use. Non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, sono venuto. Solisse spirito, solisse spirito, m'hanno chiamato. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio t'inchinami dalla mano si ne va. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio t'inchinami dalla mano si ne va. Ti li capelli tutto innamorato, li becco ti volà, li becco ti volà, li becco ti volà, talo viento. Occhi co, dici perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori. Occhi co, dici perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori.
Think of as your audience for music like this, or do you not think of it? Is it not worth thinking about?
I mean, you just can't. You can't think about audiences. You know, you just. I mean, that's.
Who do you see in the seats?
Well, I mean, it depends on where we are. I mean, we haven't actually really started touring this yet, but you know, it depends on who knows about it. I mean, this is the sort of push me pull you of being a professional musician is that if they don't hear about it, they're not going to come. You know, like, I mean, part of my mission has been trying to get the music that I play to more of the Black community, for example, which is what people always ask me. So why are there only white people at your shows? Number one, there aren't only white people at my shows. There are always people of color who come. It's just a very small percentage of the overall whole. And the other thing is that the gatekeepers of like Black culture are not interested in what I'm doing, you know, and this is a complaint I've heard from many, many people of color who do music that's not considered Black. That's not, you know,
what
whether
is, and what does that mean? What is considered Black now, and who are the gatekeepers that we're talking about?
Like, you know, like hip hop, R&B, blues. You know, well, blues. I mean, people know it's Black, but like, you know, and there's Black people who play it, but it's become
it's a largely white audience.
You know, white sure. audience and white players. Yeah. You know, as well. And jazz is one of those. It's kind of like, you know, in that kind of halfway house world. You know, and then opera. You know, there's like been there's been Black people singing opera and doing writing classical music. Forever, you know, and it's like we're seen as sort of interlopers, and so it's very hard. I've talked to other people who have the same thing. I mean, I was talking to Tavis Smiley. I was on his show because Freedom Highway. I started that tour at Sing Sing Prison, and it was the largest Black audience I've ever had, and that just like broke me in several pieces.
What was that like? Know? Tell me about that concert.
I mean, it was very intense, you know, to get like a cultural response that I'm not used to. Because
this is at Sing Sing Prison in Austin, New York.
Yeah,
just north of the city.
With the Carnegie Fountain, you know, the Carnegie Hall does this amazing program going right. in. And we worked with one of the prisoners on one of his songs about domestic violence. I mean, it was really intense. They were beautiful. And you just kind of...
So it wasn't just a performance. You were there for a while.
We did work. Yeah, we were there the whole day, you know. Mm-hmm. And you just look out that sea of brown faces and you think about what does that mean for, you know, when you talk about the incarceration of Black men and men of color and, you know, how broken the system is. But then from a purely performance point of view, I was just like, the way that they responded to the music was different than when I have, you know,
how so?
I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, like, just the energy that was given back. And I didn't know the personal stories of any of them, didn't want to know, because it's just like, that wasn't the purpose of the visit, you know?
What did you play for them?
We played a full concert. I brought my full band, and we played a lot of stuff from Freedom Highway, and so it's just like I feel very strongly like I'm starting to work with my nephew, who's a 21-year-old rapper, who plays the banjo, right? I taught.
That's an unusual combination.
It is an unusual combination. And he, you know, he's a heavy rapper. Like, this is, he knows hip hop. He knows that world. And this is the way he chooses to express himself.
You're going to record with him?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to record.
What's his name?
His name is Justin Harrington. Amazing. Demeanor is his handle. But it's just like when you start crossing over into that generation and he sees, he's like, man, when I'm playing this stuff for my friends, they're like, what is that? That's amazing. I'm like, exactly. It's like when people are exposed to this stuff, they're like, that's so cool. But getting there is the hurdle.
Rhiannon and Francesco, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Rhiannon Giddens and her collaborator, Francesco Tirisi. I spoke with them in 2019, and they're nominated for 2 Grammys for the album They're Calling Me Home. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.